This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation estimates that neglected tropical diseases affect 1 billion people worldwide, and that these diseases have the greatest impact on the most vulnerable patient communities. In response, the foundation has invested in the development and delivery of vaccines tailored to each disease and coordinated through global, regional, and local channels. I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of the IA's Global Forum. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Mary Lumpkin, who is Deputy Director, Integrated Development, and Lead for Global Regulatory Systems Initiatives at the Gates Foundation. Dr. Lumpkin chaired the session titled Vaccine Pandemic Preparedness, New Approaches, at our recent DIA Euro meeting 2017 in Glasgow. And I welcome him to today's podcast to discuss this topic in more detail. Thank you for joining us, Mac.
Thank you for having me.
How prepared is the world today to deal with the new pandemic of the likes of Ebola and Zika? Are pandemics a local problem or are they now a global problem?
People look at pandemics as perhaps initially being local, but potentially being global. And the preparation for them obviously involves the entire global community because there are levels of expertise and levels of manufacturing capabilities in different parts of the world that have to be brought to bear in both preparing for an epidemic and also in trying to meet an epidemic when you have an outbreak. I think to your question about is the world prepared, the answer is clearly not, that people realize this. I think people realize that the response to the Ebola outbreak several years ago was not what we would have wished. There were, however, I think, some very good elements and some very promising elements of the Ebola response that the global community, including the WHO, including manufacturers, regulators, local public health officials in various parts of the world, all realize are responses that can form a good foundation and that are forming a good foundation for us to build a better response capability as we look to the future.
Sounds like lessons have been learned from their experience. Those lessons placing us in a better situation to cope, or is the road ahead still very, very long and fraught with peril?
I think in reality, one of the real challenges is obviously you don't know what the pandemic is going to be, that's going to be the next one. I think we all realize it's not a question of if we have another pandemic, but rather when we have another pandemic. It could be that it is a pandemic that's caused by a microorganism that we have seen in the past, or it could be something brand new. We've seen both in the last several years. And I think that uncertainty as to what the pandemic will be adds a real complication and a real challenge as you look to putting together systems in place to meet the outbreak. Likewise, you don't know where the outbreak is going to be. If you think about it, the Ebola outbreak took place in a part of Africa where it had been known to occur, but it was not the area that people normally tended to think would be an Ebola outbreak. The Zika outbreak, even though it had been present in parts of Polynesia in the past and even in parts of Southeast Asia, it turned out it was South America that ended up being the center of the pandemic outbreak. And so this uncertainty as to where the outbreak is going to occur and what the outbreak is going to be caused by really puts a level of challenge forward. And I think people are looking at new technologies and hopefully new ways that we can create platforms that can be adapted very quickly to meet the need, depending on the geography and depending on the microbiology.
Are we in an age now where due to air travel and other modes of transportation, we can no longer think of pandemics as happening somewhere over there, but rather that we are all more or less at increased risk these days because of the modern age?
Yeah, I think that's something that we learn over and over again. I mean, if you look at the example of the SARS outbreak, how quickly it spread from Southeast Asia to Canada. If you look at the most recent Ebola outbreak and the situation we had in the United States in Dallas, when some of the people who had been working in the Ebola area were brought back home for treatment. And there is the potential. I think we always tend to think every microorganism, every outbreak is 24 hours away because it can travel by airplane to get to any place on the earth. So even though the epicenter might be over there, the danger is everywhere.
When outbreaks do happen, many people's thoughts turn to prevention and treatment. Accelerated R&D and speedy regulatory approval of new vaccines and new drugs seem essential in any effort to combat pandemics quickly. You recently authored an article on this topic titled "Speeding Access to Vaccines and Medicines in Low and Middle Income Countries, A Case for Change in a Framework for Optimized Product Market Authorization." In that article, what were your main recommendations?
I think that article really was not primarily focused on the pandemic situation, but the more normal routine situation of trying to get needed medical products to the most vulnerable patients in the world and trying to deal with some of the regulatory challenges and distribution challenges and procurement challenges that exist in trying to get new products and needed products to low-income countries and to those in the low-income countries who need them. And that was really the focus of that article. In that article, we talked about some of the strategies that we here at the Foundation have undertaken with partners in the last 3 to 4 years to begin to address some of these regulatory process challenges and some of the regulatory science challenges. Our partners in this are WHO, the regional offices of WHO, the national regulatory authorities, both in low-income countries and high-income countries, and the various regulatory alignment and regulatory harmonization initiatives, particularly the regional approaches to regulation that are taking on much more prominence in many different parts of the world today. So that was really more of a focus on what we might do as a larger community to try to optimize the regulatory processes that these global health products have to go through in order to ultimately be used and distributed legally in the low-income countries that we're focusing on. I think when we talk about pandemics and the need for developing products for pandemics, it clearly presents some unique challenges that perhaps we don't see quite in the same way with the more routine products. And the biggest challenge is trying to develop a product in the absence of an outbreak, which particularly in the world of vaccines, and these are some of the things we talked about in Glasgow and others and other fora are looking at, is realizing that without an outbreak, you can only go so far in developing a vaccine against a given pathogen. We can test it in animals. We can test it as far as safety and immunogenicity in normal human volunteers. But what we can't do is determine what that immunogenicity means in terms of protection and the duration of protection, because we don't have an outbreak and we don't have clinical data to actually show that the vaccine is doing what we hope it's going to do. In other words, we really don't have immunologic correlates of protection, which we would normally have in the situation of trying to develop a vaccine against a routine disease. And this presents to the regulatory authorities, to the procurers, to the patients, to the governments, a reality that when you get to the point of having an outbreak, we're not going to have as much data on these vaccines as we would normally have in a routine situation. And it always comes back to that risk-benefit and risk-tolerance decision. that regulators and companies and governments and patients have to make in the context of an epidemic outbreak. How much risk of the unknown when it comes to a vaccine are you willing to take, given what we know about the risk of the outbreak at that point in time? So I think these are some of the regulatory procedural questions, some of the regulatory science questions that many people in the global community are trying to help answer. If you look at the WHO, they have an R&D blueprint that they have developed that builds on the lessons learned by the global community from the Ebola outbreak. There are different others that we can talk about later if you wish, such as the CEPI initiative, where people are trying to come together and say, you know, how can we plan? How can we best estimate what the next outbreak might be? Which are the pathogens that might be most devastating and most virulent? What do we know about them? How far can we develop a vaccine in the absence of an outbreak? Is it possible with new technologies to develop a vaccine platform that we can get a certain amount of data, and then when we have an outbreak, put the appropriate antigen on the vaccine, as it were, to deal with that particular outbreak? So there's a tremendous amount of work, both in the technology development, in the development of and validation of animal models, and in trying to figure out how to interpret human immunogenicity responses in various potential outbreak situations. So it's a little bit different there, and I think you do see from a regulatory process perspective, as we saw in Ebola, that the communities are willing. Under, in the United States, for example, the emergency use authorization in the European Union under their conditional authorizations, in what WHO did during the Ebola crisis in creating their emergency use assessment and listing procedure for vaccines and medicines and diagnostics, where everybody realizes you're not going to have as much information as you would like, but at a certain point, the community at large is willing to say, given the outbreak, we are willing to use these vaccines and diagnostics and medicines under certain specific circumstances. So there has been a lot done procedurally. There's been a lot done in the regulatory science world to try to address a lot of these issues to help us be better prepared next time so that when the outbreak occurs, we are ready to respond clearly to help protect the first responders as best as we can, because I think that was one of the lessons from the Ebola crisis, that they are truly the front line and we have to protect them if they are then going to be able to protect the rest of us. How do you use these vaccines in first responders? How do you use them in clinical trials once the outbreak occurs to answer the questions about the vaccine that you can't answer except in an appropriately designed, interpretable clinical trial? And then also the questions of how to use them in the context of a pandemic, as was done in the Ebola in the ring approach that WHO did in Guinea, to try to break the pandemic. So these are things that WHO and the larger community are working on, as I say again, to try to help us be better prepared in terms of our regulatory procedures, in terms of the products that we have available, and in terms of the science that allows us to make the best public health decision we can under the circumstances of a pandemic outbreak.
You spent a couple of decades as a regulator at very senior levels at the FDA in the United States. Speaking as a regulator or a former one with great experience, when these outbreaks do happen, is there a temptation by regulators to lower the bar just because they just need to get something out there to first responders or to sufferers to get anything out there to them? Is the bar lowered in these emergency situations on the part of regulators?
Quite honestly, I think it depends on how you define the bar. If people are looking at the bar as, well, we're not going to let something out unless it meets the evidentiary and safety standard that we would impose for yet another drug to treat a common urinary tract infection, right, then yes.
Right.
But that's not the situation. I mean, the bar on all products is, what do we know that this product does? What do we know about the risks of this product? And what do we not know about this product? And are we willing to use this product given the reality of the disease we're dealing with in spite of the lack of knowledge that we have on the product? And I think that is the bar that applies to every product. And it is always in the context of what we know about the disease, what other options are available, that let you say, where does that risk tolerance start to play in? It's not an evidentiary standard difference. It's a risk tolerance difference when you're dealing with a common urinary tract infection or you're dealing with a pandemic for which nothing is available. And so I think people are using the same thought process for each of these products. So I would argue that the thought process and the decision-making process standard is the same, but what you are willing to accept clearly depends on the context and what you know about the product and what you know about the disease. And I would hope that is the standard that regulators do use, because we are responsible for trying to get products that help people to them in situations where the patients are willing to take risks and the community is willing to take risks that they think are less than the risks of the disease that they're faced with.
So there is an adjustment, if you will, in expectations and willingness to take risks, as I think you're saying, in relation to an emergency situation where many people will be willing to try anything just to try to alleviate their suffering.
But I wouldn't go so far as to say, even if people are willing to try anything, I don't think anything is the bar here. It's not an open the door, let anything go out. And I don't think most people would be willing to try just anything. I think they would want to know that there is some evidence that this might help them, that it's not, you know, really not probably going to make their situation worse. And that varies from situation to situation as to where that risk tolerance comes in. And I think, you know, what regulators and the public health community have to do is answer honestly to the community and say, this is what we know about these products, and this is what we don't know, and this is where we think they fit into the armamentarium to address the outbreak.
You mentioned a few moments ago CEPI, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. CEPI and the WHO in September 2016 signed a memorandum of understanding on global regulatory optimization and alignment. What does this MOU accomplish? How does it contribute to vaccine pandemic preparedness?
It's a great question, and I think early on there was perhaps a little confusion as to roles and responsibilities, and I think the people at CEPI and at WHO through the MOU are trying to make it clear to the larger community that obviously WHO has the lead in setting the policies and bringing the community together to address public health emergencies of international concern. But what WHO does not do is actually develop the product that you need to try to address those. And CEPI is really an umbrella organization that is bringing together the manufacturers of vaccines, academics who are involved in the early development of vaccines and new ways of approaching treating epidemic diseases, regulators and others, so that the combined knowledge and effort of people who are actually trying to develop the products can be coordinated and focused so that there will be products that are available that can meet and hopefully begin to address some of the epidemics that we're talking about. So it is really an effort that is very complementary to the WHO R&D blueprint, and it really is the product development part that feeds into the WHO R&D blueprint. And so what CEPI and WHO wanted to do was to make sure that the efforts were coordinated, that indeed the decisions on the product development that were being made by the manufacturers fed in and were fed by the information that WHO had, and really were quite complementary to the efforts that WHO was doing through their R&D blueprint from a policy and a procedure perspective.
Let's turn for a moment, if we may, to the role of industry in this whole situation. What are the opportunities and even the social obligations for industry to contribute to vaccine pandemic preparedness?
At the end of the day, obviously, industry has the expertise and the wherewithal to actually produce the vaccines that are going to be needed. So industry is a critical key player in this whole process. And I think one of the really good things that came out of the Ebola situation was we saw that people were able to actually produce vaccines quicker than we had ever seen under routine circumstances. And so there were a lot of lessons learned about how to focus resources, how to share information, how to try to develop vaccines as expeditiously as possible without sacrificing scientific robustness and the safety parameters that we all know have to be there. I think one of the things we also learned is that this is a very resource-intensive effort to develop vaccines. It is costly, both in terms of the actual costs of developing the vaccines, but also in the opportunity cost that the industry loses when all of a sudden the world is faced with a pandemic and they have to turn and focus on developing products for that particular epidemic, as opposed to their normal business and their normal work and everything that their systems are set up for working on in a more routine way. And so one of the things that CEPI is trying to do, realizing that epidemics are not the kinds of things that are the blockbusters, are not the economic drivers, but are really the social responsibility drivers that are behind them, to see how can they bring industry together to appropriately share information, share knowledge, share resources as best as they can, to use the resources as wisely as possible to meet the needs that have to be met as a global community when we have these kind of epidemics.
In your observation, has industry readily stepped up when these crises have occurred and tried everything it could to help, or have you observed any reluctance, tentativeness, even resistance by industry to participate in these efforts?
Well, I think if you look at both Zika situation, if you look at the Ebola situation, the industry was there on the vaccine side and clearly on the diagnostic side too, to try to use their expertise and the manufacturing capacities that they uniquely have to try to address this. I think there are some legitimate issues that were brought to the forefront. Liability in these kind of situations. There are legitimate issues about production costs and opportunity costs that are lost. And I think that's one of the things that CEPI and the donors for CEPI and WHO are trying to address, to see how can we as a larger community address some very legitimate issues that industry is raising so that they can do what they uniquely need to do and have to do when these kind of outbreaks occur.
Is industry sometimes concerned about product liability that might arise from these situations, or is that not really something that comes up?
It is something that comes up because, again, these are products that, when they are going to be used, do not have the normal fund of knowledge, as it were, when they're being used. And again, that is because of the context and the situation and the reality of developing products for an outbreak in the absence of the outbreak. Obviously, there is a risk of the unknown there, and what kind of liability does that create as we go forward? I think, you know, there have been issues about vaccine liability in the past, in the normal situation, that countries have addressed in different ways quite successfully. And the question has been raised, I mean, can we address those issues on a global perspective? And I do think that is something that WHO and others are looking at as a way to try to, you know, assure that we will have the response from industry that we need when these epidemics occur.
As you and I discussed in the past, during the height of the Ebola pandemic, you worked very closely with WHO, in fact, at WHO, and with a number of African ministers of health to facilitate the development and distribution of Ebola vaccines. What did you learn during that very unique experience?
You know, it was a wonderful experience. It was incredibly busy, but an incredible number of very, very dedicated people, both at the National Regulatory Authority level, at the Ethics Board level, at the AFRO level, which AFRO is the regional office of WHO for the African continent, and at the Geneva headquarters level. I think people realized that in order to meet the crisis as efficiently as possible, they needed to be coordinated. The reviews of the clinical trial applications for the phase three trials that were going to be run in the three countries that were the focal point of the epidemic and in some of the surrounding countries had to be coordinated. WHO and AFRO did a tremendous job using the AVRF platform of bringing the African regulators, the African ethics boards, and the experts from some of the well-resourced agencies who had also already looked at these vaccines because many of the phase one trials had been done in Europe and North America, but bringing them all together so that the experience and the expertise could be shared such that the African regulators, in a much more efficient, well-informed way, could make the decisions they had to make about allowing the clinical trials to proceed in their countries, which for many of them was a very new undertaking. And they were having to undertake it in the midst of tremendous pressures on their healthcare system and in the situation of just devastation of their population in many different areas and great vulnerability and great fear, a situation that, you know, would be difficult for regulators in any part of the world. So by bringing people together, supporting them both in terms of scientific knowledge and experience, but also in process and in the way decisions are made in these certain situations, really was seeing the global community, regulatory community come together in its best to work to get these trials up and going in a very quick and very efficient manner. And what's good from that is that particular process, the AVRF process, because of the experience during Ebola, has reinvigorated itself and renewed itself with a new set term of reference. It has actually now become a way not only of doing clinical trials in Africa in emergency situations, but doing multi-country clinical trials in Africa now in more routine situations. So it is a process that was informed by the Ebola outbreak, has been improved by the Ebola outbreak, and I think will be even in a better position when the next outbreak occurs to be used in a very efficient manner to get needed clinical trials authorized locally, both by the ethics boards and by the regulatory authorities.
That's a really inspiring situation. Well, we'll close here. And Mac, I want to thank you for your illuminating and thoughtful responses, as always. Thank you very much for your time today, Mac.
Thank you for yours.
For DIA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.